HBO, that's what I'm trying to tell you.
Thank you.
See, I told you he's back.
Are you really doing Goo Goo Dolls? Is that what we're doing?
Someone came in and said, when John walks in, if we play the Goo Goo Dolls, remember that you and John danced to that.
Where's Fred?
Fred's back here.
Where'd you go, Fred? Should we dance? Should we reprise our role?
Why not? Seems like a thing to do.
Look at us.
That was really stupid when we did that.
Well, we were very stupid.
That was the height of stupid. We were way ahead of this whole gay wave.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, it was like the first gay dance party.
I believe I, though, was dressed as an officer, was I not?
Yes.
I believe I was an officer.
You were the gentleman and I was a woman.
I think that's probably right. And there was a gentleman who was wearing bikini briefs with like a toucan nose.
Oh my.
Scott the engineer, I think that was. Yeah. What an ass on him.
We delightful.
Were so, you know, John,
it was
a
delightful and simpler time.
We were so young and gay back then.
Yes,
now
we really
are. Now we try to disguise all that. But anyway.
Yeah, you guys could act like idiots because the rest of the world was sane.
That's probably true.
You know, I was thinking about your last show. First of all.
Yes.
I do want to talk about semi-retirement in a sense I'm always fascinated by this because people around here anyway, when I ask them, they always say, oh, John Stewart's miserable now because he misses the limelight. He misses the Daily Show. He misses being on there, you know? And I go, I don't think he does.
No.
But you know what I was thinking? What John Oliver does is one day a week. I think if you had done that, you might have stayed in the game.
That's probably true.
Right?
Although, I think you'd also get tired of that. Like, it's at a certain point, and you see, you have to evolve something. And I think I got to a point where I kind of didn't think I could do anything else with it.
Yeah.
And thank God I did, because before Trump came, you need somebody who's 32, 33, still has that type of energy, that type of stamina.
That fire.
That fire to go at it. I think I would have phoned it in. I was making decisions about bits towards the end of the Daily Show based on if I would have to change my clothes.
I know. Like
that's how lazy I had gotten at that point where I would...
You didn't want to go out on the street, let's say, or you didn't want to go do a field piece or...
We got this. You're just doing an insert into this bit. We're just going to, throw your suit on it. And I'm like, is that downstairs? They're like, yeah, it's downstairs. I'm like, you know what? Let me just, why don't we do this in my office? And how about I wear a t-shirt?
And so you probably sat down with yourself and said, if I'm to be honest, I'm not really into this job. And I really don't want to knock myself out every day. And I don't want to diminish what I've done. Like, I want to keep it.
And you also don't want to diminish because the other people then, if you start falling behind, they kind of have to pull harder.
Right.
And so you do get to a certain point where, people are kind of having to cover your cracks in the system.
Yeah.
So I felt like it was absolutely the right time. I was burnt on it. I was burnt on the system. It was just at the beginning of social media had just started to become a part of it. And that's sort of the weight of that and that, like, the churn of that.
I could imagine in social media, you must have gotten, I'm talking, not by liberals, obviously, but I'm talking about by, conservatives, people who disagree with you. It must have been.
No, liberals too. You
liberals too, if you don't do the right, like everything you get jumped on,
everything.
Right? Like everything.
And you can always tell, I could always tell if the right was mad at me, it would be, they would always use my birth name. So if any time, like, if you did something that angered the conservatives or the right-leaning thing, it would always be like, poor Johnny Leibowitz.
Well, Trump started doing it.
Well, he started doing it to me first. So they jumped on that. If the left was mad at me, there it was always, remember, this man is a literal piece of shit. Like it was, it always had a very different vibe depending on which side was firing
out. I was
gonna
bring that up because I have found as a Jew, when someone wants to get to you, they go, oh, Leibowitz. When Trump would say, oh, what's the matter, John Leibowitz? What does that really mean? That does cut, right? It cuts into you.
I think it means it plays into the conspiracy of crypto Jews.
Yeah.
Jews that are passing but are actually working for the Bilderberg Group or the Illuminati, and have been placed out as sleeper cells into a variety of different.
Does that kind of attack work? Because a lot of Jewish people feel a lot of sense of shame and guilt over all the anti-Semitism they've been whacked with, and somehow you start to get defensive. But like, what's wrong with saying Leibowitz? But yet it does. Right. It's like that's some sort of attack on you.
Well, I think because it's not explicit, you can deal with somebody when they're being explicit. So I think what happens is when there's like racism, when there's passive aggressive racism, you just want to say like, just say it.
Yeah.
Just say Jews you think are up to something.
Right.
Don't make this implication. And it was surprising because I couldn't figure out what Trump's motivation was for the attack. Because generally, he will attack if he feels like, you know, his whole thing is, hey, I punch back.
Right.
So, but sometimes people will just make even a constructive statement or a criticism that is legitimate and not below the belt. And he'll just come back with shit that's just, he'll burn the house down. That's
his punch back to you was calling you Leibowitz.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it got funnier because, you know, so I came back, I don't have a Twitter, but at the show we have a Twitter. So, you know, his real name is John Leibowitz. Why does he run from his heritage if he's so above board? Meanwhile, probably half the people on the show, I think, you know, Steve Carell was Steve Carelli. Asif Mandavali. Colbert was Colbert.
People in show business do change their names.
They do change their names.
Right.
And I didn't care for my father. So there's a whole other
thing. Right. Your parents divorced when you were young. It was not a pretty sight. Right.
So he comes firing back with that. So we come back with, you know, well, Donald Trump's real name is Fuckface Von Clownstick. And why does he run from the Von Clownstick heritage? Why is he not proud of? So this sends him into a frenzy. And now people are just, you know, now the wasp hive of the internet, the relentless certainty of the internet, has just jumped on him with Fuckface Von Clownstick. So now he's in a position where he has to tweet out to all the losers and haters who are tweeting Fuckface Von Clownstick like it's so original. And it's so it goes to the whole thing. The whole, I guess, Twitter war ultimately ends. And then 3 days later at 2:30 in the morning, so there's been no, and we weren't even sure what started the whole thing. I think the last tweet we sent out was, I guess we hit a Fuckface Von Nerve Stick or something like that.
So now you feel like you're in fifth grade.
Exactly.
Right.
So nothing. 2:30 in the morning, little John Stewart is a pussy and would be helpless in a debate with me. And that's it.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
But it's 2:30 in the morning. It's like a sneak attack.
Yeah. So, you know, but like in the weirdest way, like you imagine, and now he's the president, but you imagine like Lincoln at 2:30 in the morning being like, little Robert E. Lee is a pussy.
But in a way, you know, as good as you are at sort of making fun of all this stuff, it gets fatiguing, you know.
Oh, there's no question it's fatiguing.
It really is, because you go from doing the Daily Show and you're trying to make people laugh and you're coming at them with politics, but still trying to be funny and everything.
Right.
And then the wave of criticisms and tweets come rattling in, and I guess it just weighs on you. And it's sort of sad because it almost forces you into retirement. When I was thinking about it yesterday, and the world has become such a dark place, I knew you were coming in, and then I saw you were on the Today Show, and they of course ask you about Louis C.K. because he's a friend of yours, he's a friend of mine.
Because it's an autism benefit. Why wouldn't you ask?
Why? You're trying to promote. But I thought, gee, this is so weird. It was almost like the question becomes an attack on you. Well, what are you going to do now about your friend Louis C.K.?
Sure.
And it's like, I don't fucking know. Right. I mean, the bottom line is, you know what? This is all very fucking confusing.
Yes, that is correct. Yep. But it's also, you know, I have a tendency. The way that I kind of work is the first instinct you get on attack is a little defensive.
Yeah.
And then it takes me a while to get over the defensiveness and try and like close my eyes a little bit and you know, rabbi it. That's why I grew the beard now, so I can go like, okay, what
you mean by rabbi, you say to try to consider other points of view about this. Right.
So you try and rabbinical it. I'll give you an example of this that happened, and it's in a similar lane. All right. Because this was in like early 2000s, maybe the mid 2000s, an article on a website called Jezebel, which is like a feminist leaning like webzine, I guess it is, or like a website, like, right. You know, so they write a big expose of the Daily Show, and it's, you know, sort of boys club, mentality. And my first response is like, what the fuck? Like, no. I'm an OG feminist, man. I was raised by a single mother in the 70s. Like, she had a shirt that said, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. Like, I felt like shit in my own house for being...
You were the enemy.
For being me. Right. You know, she referred to my father as Mr. Wonderful, literally now, because he died a while back. And so now she refers to him as, like, you know, ex-Mr. Wonderful, like, but like with acid. I was like, no.
So you were very emotionally attached to your mother and also considered her point of view a lot and were raised by a very feminist thinking woman, forward thinking woman.
That's exactly right. So yeah. I this thing comes out and I'm like, this is bullshit. Like,
how can this be?
And there are things in it that are untrue, and there are things in it that are clearly, as you say, an implication of true piggishness.
Yeah.
That I felt was untrue. So I go back to the writer's room and I'm like, you fucking believe this? You know,
your buddies.
This saying to me, you know, this is a boys club. Steve, what do you think of that?
No way, John.
Matt?
No way.
Carl?
No way.
Three guys with beards and glasses whose names I don't know who are in flannel shirts. And then I looked around.
We like women.
That's exactly right. And I looked around the room and I was like, oh, that's what they meant. And so the hardest part is to get over your defensiveness, to find that kernel of constructive information that's
in
there.
Is there something in this argument?
That's right. So what am I missing? And then with that, I realized, oh, that's right. Now we thought, oh, we were ahead of that because we do blind submissions. So it's not sexist. But you realize is, oh, when you call agents for writers, because that's the only way you get the submissions, they're only sending you white dudes from Harvard.
Right.
And so you realize the system, the tributary that feeds the system, is actually where a lot of it, you know, lays, and that you have to make to change that system takes actual effort.
Yeah, well, you're under the microscope too, because if you're the guy doing right. comedy, but also doing a political thing,
yeah.
And you're talking about Roy Moore's right. an asshole, and that's this
right.
one's this and that,
and you're right and you're, on everything.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But
they were right.
The crux of the criticism, right? So if I could get past my own defensiveness of
right.
it was kind of right.
It's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
Well, nobody likes to be called on their bullshit. It's right. not a pleasant thing.
Yeah.
And so in this situation, you know, the only reason that the Louis thing came up is I'm trying to promote a benefit.
Yeah, and Louis was booked for it.
And he was booked for it.
Yeah.
And it is the story right now of the thing. I mean, look at the setup here. You and I sit very comfortably surrounded by water. The woman is in a terrarium.
That's right.
Where she's allowed
to
speak.
Well, you're still trying to determine what
that's
my
right.
purpose
We're
is.
We're trying to determine it. She's not allowed to have
she's
our air.
She's in a protective booth.
That's right.
No our one wants air. To be in my air.
We have the good air.
Yeah.
She's over there in the ladies' air.
I'm hoping that they give me
that's
air.
That's right.
No, but
yes.
I guess my point was that yep. that it seemed like you are now getting attacked because you're supposed to come up with the perfect answer Louis C.K. And it's like,
gee,
maybe I don't have the answer to everything. Maybe all of this is kind of new information and right. I haven't had time to rabbi it.
Well, even Howard and I have right. been grappling right. with it and saying, we don't know what to do about this.
Right.
You know, I do get that. I am defensive about it.
Yeah.
You know, when the people have that certainty of, you knew, I know that I didn't know.
They uh-huh.
So you have to look at it in the context. So my context is when I say, like, Louis's my great friend, a lot of great friends that I started with and that I work with, I don't have their phone numbers. I don't have their emails. When we see each other,
your
you
friends.
Fall right back into,
right.
it's lovely to see them. You know, what's been nice about promoting the special is I get to see guys like Steve Higgins and Steven, and you know, well, Steven and I are close, so we, you know, we're always talking and in contact, and he's a true friend in the sense of
right.
an ongoing relationship. But I see guys that I haven't seen in 20 years that I worked with that I love, but we don't talk
mm-hmm.
in and communicate in that way. But in their eyes, we all, in the same way, in like my mother's eyes, like when Woody Allen got in trouble, my mother said to me, like, did he ever tell you that? And I'm like, I don't know.
He
Woody
doesn't talk
Allen.
To you. Yeah.
We're not. We don't
There's
have
no
a
club.
A show business brunch,
yeah.
Right? But I consider Louis, and still do, a friend in that way. Yes. Like whenever we saw each other, I love to see him. I love him as a comic.
Right.
He was fun to work with when we worked together. This was, you know, 25 years ago, whatever. But in my context, so I got asked about this in about a year and a half ago on a podcast for David Axelrod, and a kid stood up in the audience. So my context to that is I'm at a podcast. David Axelrod has one more question. Now, we've been doing audience questions, so it's a lot of banter. It's a lot of funny banter.
Yeah.
Okay. So the kid says, Louis C.K. was on your last show. And I'm like, yeah. You know, I'm still in. You know, what do you think of the sexual allegations? So, and I was just like, wait, what?
What an allegation?
So then I'm like, what the fuck did you just say?
Yeah.
And so he starts talking about a woman's podcast. Now, I'm not really in the comedy world anymore.
Right.
So I don't know who this person is that he mentions. And right. He does mention Gawker. So to him, right, he knows about it.
You don't.
He's a kid in Chicago, not in the comedy field. Not he knows about it.
Right.
He's all over it. He's heard it on this podcast. He's a thing. I'm in the comedy business.
Right. Yeah.
I'm friends with the guy that he's talking about. I have no idea what he's talking about. I've never heard of the woman in the podcast.
And you're not in the business of accusing people based on some kid in an audience. You'd want to hear some more facts about it.
Yes. But I understand on his, so I had to rabbi it a little bit in the sense of, so I have a very different relationship with the internet than kids his age do. They see it as a democratizing place where you are finding information and finding your way into things that you never had a chance to. I see it as a place where lies become fact, become canon in an instant.
Yeah.
And there's shit on there about me that I know to be untrue that is now taken. It's like an information laundering system.
Yep.
It starts out as a rumor.
It's journalism.
And then people just cite it.
Sure.
So that's my experience with the internet. Now.
And my experience is I just watch babysitter porn on there. You know? I mean, that's what I use it for.
You're really out of the loop on this one.
I'm an old man.
That is the truest sense of what it's
I mean, that's
for.
It. It's you porn.
But now let's look at it from his perspective.
Right.
He's heard all about this. He's ensconced. The woman on the podcast is someone that he is a fan of, respects. Maybe he know, like feels like he trusts her. So this comes out. So to him, imagine it's like a horror movie. All right. You're running. You're being chased by a monster. You see a house with a light on it. You know the person who lives in the house, me, supposed to be a good guy. So you knock on the door. I open the door and I'm like, hey, man, because there's a monster coming. I go, wait, what? Monster? Yeah, there's a monster chasing. Who told you there was a monster chasing you? The kids down the street. Oh, the kids down the street.
Right.
Yeah, they go. And you shut the door and he's like, how the fuck do you not see that there's a monster? It's like how I felt when I went to Telluride at a film festival and I get out, it's 10,000 feet elevation and I can't breathe. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking around and everybody else is acting normal. Right. And I'm just sitting there like, why isn't anybody? And you're like grabbing people going like, how are you pushing a shopping cart? I can't breathe.
Right.
And so when I look at it from that perspective, I go, okay, now their reaction makes sense to me. They're furious. And they've been dealing with this for years and years. And so for me to express even my obliviousness
is an insult
and is an indictment.
Right.
And that.
Yeah, you're avoiding the topic.
Correct.
Oh, you're dismissing it. You're doing the same old thing that perpetuates.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So after this, I do check it out. So I take a deep dive. I get into this podcast. So it comes out. It's a blind item. The woman says, actually, it's not me. Another comedian says, that's me. Not Luke. So I feel like, well, I guess my job is done here, isn't it?
Right.
So the real question for me. So here's the rabbi question.
Right.
I didn't know.
Right.
What if I did?
Okay.
That's the thing that bothers me. What if I did? What if I had known one of the women who was making the accusations? And I don't. I know they're in the comedy world, but I had not heard of them. But let's say I did. And one of them came to me and said, 10 years ago or whatever, Louis did this.
what would you have done?
Would I still have worked with them? Would I still greet them? Like, that's the part.
You can't answer that question.
I can't honestly answer. And that makes me feel shitty. That's the one thing, John, that makes me feel, I'll give you some insight into that, in the sense
that I had heard from a woman in the comedy thing.
Right.
That, in fact, this happened to her. But when
Same guy or different guy?
Louis.
Oh, okay. All right.
And the way it was presented to me was in a much different way. That it was some kind of consensual thing that she thought was hysterical. Like, funny. Like
the woman herself said
that's
that.
Right.
Right.
And that's the only thing I had ever heard about it. And I went, oh, you mean like, it, you know, it was consensual. It was like something they did. And she was just kind of curious about it. So it wasn't like a, it was like
curious, in the way of
why is a comedian doing this? And like, and like, she was not offended by it. She was actually more of a curiosity. She wasn't like felt threatened or anything like that. I had heard that. And I thought, well, okay, it's nothing I'm into. I am not, my sexuality has never been weird or for somebody or even wanted to, God forbid anyone saw my penis, let alone jerk off in front of them. I don't, that's nothing I get and nothing I condone. But at the same point, if two people want to do that in a room and no one's being forced,
that's their business.
That's their business. That's sort of how I interpreted all of this.
But that was that story.
That was just one story. That's all I had heard.
Right.
Many years ago.
But if you had heard...
And I didn't even know if it was true, really. It was like someone told me about someone, you know.
But it's that, so what the internet provides for folks is an sort of an unrelenting certainty. Right. So what happens is, if you go on and you say, I didn't know, the internet or those that are in like the wasp hive, for that one particular item, and there's different hives, just come flying in and go, fuck you, you know, you were a piece of shit. I don't believe you.
Because you're a comedian and you know what every comedian's up to.
That's right. Well, so that's the part where you get defensive about.
Yeah, and a lot of that is going on with Harvey Weinstein, too. Like, how could this whole company not have known?
But then I think to myself, like on a website that keeps writing articles about like putting the word stunned in quotation, like they'll write like John Stewart said he was stunned, you know, in quotations, like, can you believe this asshole?
Right. You can do no right.
We all knew. And then you feel like, well, you're like a pretty reputable journalism website. Like, why didn't you write the article? Like, everybody knew, but I think that apparently they were waiting for me.
John Stewart, why didn't you bring Walter Cronkite.
I think what they don't understand as well sometimes is, like, I live a reclusive and somewhat oblivious life. And is that my fault? But so the part that I really, the real part that I criticize myself on is what would I have done if I actually had known?
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
My feeling is, and I'm trying to be as honest with myself as I can, I would not have done something. I just don't think I would have. And like, now I know John Quinones is going to come out with the cameras and be like, you're a dick, you're never making my show. But
right.
I feel like I wouldn't have felt the urgency of it.
I know what you mean in the sense that like, you know, I'm grappling with this too. Like if you hear about a rape, it's clear, you know, fuck this.
And but not every rape is clear.
No, not every rape. But I mean, I know women who have been raped who haven't come forward. And, you know, but that's their decision to make. But I'll tell you what, that I wouldn't stand for. And that I know, that's clear, you know. And it's like this whole thing, everyone expects you to have the answers.
But they would say it's not that they're making the decision not to come forward. It's that the atmosphere around coming forward is so toxic.
It is.
So what their,
it's more victimization.
Correct. So what their point is on my reactions to it, again, trying to, is by not immediately embracing the kid with his sexual allegations thing or being flippant, because that was the atmosphere of the Q&A, you're contributing to an atmosphere that is toxic for somebody to speak what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the flip side of that, if they're going to be rabbinical about it and look at the other way, I'm an individual that, like, I still believe in my own decency. Like, I don't, the internet doesn't know who I am and it doesn't shake the foundation of thinking I'm a decent person, but I am fallible as fuck and make mistakes, but I can grow. I'm the type of person, hopefully, that can be helpful.
Yes.
Because I think I can still learn and still change behavior it may take time. It may, you know, so
I think that's very
they,
fair.
But when they all come at me for using the word stunned instead of surprised, or not being in just completely like, sir, what you say to me is shaking me to my core, and I'm going to go out. You know, I got to call my friend, called me this morning. He goes like, Ellen Barkin thinks you're a tool.
Wow.
Really? And I'm like, wait, what?
Why? What did you do?
Because of the Today Show thing, or because, you know, this writer thinks you're a piece of shit who's lying. And so what it does to me is create a toxic environment for the learning, for even is understanding, that- for even working this out. It makes me feel like, you know what? Fuck them. I'm a decent person.
And you didn't do anything wrong.
I didn't do anything wrong explicitly, but I'm part of a system that like does but treat people poorly.
This is what I'm talking about, why you probably are enjoying not doing the Daily Show.
Completely.
Completely. You're a thoughtful guy. I know you to be, you know, again, I don't know you super well, but I know you to be like a you know, a decent guy and thoughtful. And it's got to be fatiguing where everyone is saying, mm-hmm. oh, John's a piece of shit. No, John's a good guy. It's so fucking much attention. I mean, that's part of why you go into show business. But
exactly.
This has become so goddamn toxic.
Right.
I'm talking about just not just even this Harvey Weinstein stuff and all that. It's just the Twitter and the constant fucking like, got you.
And the certainty. So but here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
I feel like in some respects, I started that. And that's where it goes, oh, so now I'm being hoisted on slightly my own petard, because when I was doing the comedy, now I would say we were very careful about context and we tried to layer our arguments fairly and smartly, but the internet utilized that as eviscerates. So like where we would think like, you know, poked fun at this, it became he eviscerated or he destroyed. So you became weaponized.
And you know what my point is on all this? So here's something you did, the Daily Show. And, now even you're viewing it like, oh, I'm to blame. This was negative. You know what I mean? This is like a great thing you did. You had a great accomplishment. And it's so goddamn annoying and fatiguing.
But who am I to enjoy life?
Right.
But you know
but
what?
By the way.
What?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
What I see about this is, you know, they anoint you. You know, so the anointing happens before all of the arrows are slung.
So
you were the guy who taught us to laugh again after tragedy, and you knew the right moment or that.
I think we're talking about constant judgment. That's all.
Yeah.
And so
maybe that weighs on you.
Hey, you know, I was thinking the last Daily Show you did.
Yes.
You had Bruce Springsteen on.
Oh, yeah.
Did you go see Springsteen's show on Broadway?
Oh, my God.
Have
you seen it?
Yes.
It's brilliant.
Brilliant. Did you read his book?
Yes.
Yes. Now, I thought the book was terrific. And what he managed to do was take the book and take certain passages and then incorporate music with the book.
Yes.
And that's what he's doing on Broadway.
That's right.
And
the way he ties it together at the end, I was not expecting the kind of emotional wallop that it packed. And it shook me a little bit.
Me too.
I think, and let me, all right, so let's dig into this. You and I have pretty much the same Jew face.
Very, we
your
could be
hair,
twins.
Your hair, by the way, does a great job of, in some ways, obscuring your Jew face.
I think it makes my Jew face
if I see you now, I still look like, how is he so young? And then I get closer and I go, oh yeah, okay.
It's the hair.
He's me. Right. He's got the Jew face.
Right.
Because we are, look, let's face facts about Jews.
But by the way, you went gray. But
yeah, look, you went beard, though.
So do you.
No, I'm a little bit gray.
Oh, is that true? You're not that, but that's dyed.
No.
Oh, that's amazing.
No, I've never colored my hair.
But so look at Robin.
Yes.
Look at how beautiful and like radiant and young Robin.
Watch it. I'll have you up on charges.
So they say
they're coming on her.
So you know the expression.
Yeah.
Black don't crack.
Right.
Jews age like avocados.
How so?
You leave us out for just a little bit and we turn like brown and weird and moldy and shitty.
Is that true?
Like almost. Yeah. Jews are like, you know how like when you're at a Mexican restaurant, they bring you guacamole.
Yeah.
And then you like turn your head for a second and go, hey man, can I also get another lemonade? What the fuck happened to my guacamole?
Right. Just don't get let brown. It sit
what's
there
that?
Too long.
What's that weird covering? That's what I feel like.
When you did the Daily Show, did you color your hair?
No.
Never, right?
No.
It just went gray.
Yeah, it went gray pretty fast.
Right. I am very fortunate.
Oh, you're unbelievably fortunate.
But there's gray in here.
Yeah. But the Springsteen thing. What I find so amazing about him is his ability to vividly describe and be a part of, like, he experienced his life. It's a great life. It's this grand experience. But he somehow is also detached enough from it to be able to capture it vividly, like almost like a novelist.
Yeah.
Like he has the language of like a Flannery O'Connor or, you know, Faulkner, like the way that he describes a time and a place.
Yeah, I was so moved by it.
Moved.
Yeah, yeah. It was really a really great thing. Do you this show that you're doing for HBO, the charity thing.
That's right.
A Night of a Thousand Stars. Or too many stars.
Yeah. Yes. One less than we had before.
Right. Yeah. Well,
but we're doing the best we can. That's right.
I still say he's going to show up. It's going to be the biggest thing ever.
You'll be able to limp along.
But is this part of your overall deal with HBO? Because you have a deal with HBO.
I have a deal with HBO, yeah.
And the deal involved an animated show or an animated special.
Well, no, a whole, not an animated special. So,
what is this deal?
This is horrible.
Okay.
So, I had an idea that imagine you're doing the Daily Show and you're about to leave and you're thinking to yourself, what am I going to do and how am I going to support? My wife runs an animal sanctuary.
Like a 45-acre farm you guys live on.
We're moving over, yeah.
Right.
We don't live on it, but you know, I need to afford pig and sheep care.
Yeah, I know. My wife wants to meet your wife very badly.
Would get along.
She wants to hear about all of this.
Oh, and
she wants to somehow be involved.
And the nice thing about my wife, truly, like, compassion in a way, like, just, she's one of those people that kind of lights it up, like, walks in and you just feel like, oh, a good person just came in.
That's how I feel about my wife.
Yeah.
Is the animal sanctuary thing something you get into, or are you removed from it?
No, I mean, again, it's that feeling of once you see something, you can't unsee it. So in the way I was talking about, like, you know, women see the way that they're treated and the fact that it takes men like a while to come across and be like, oh, it is shitty here, isn't it?
Yeah. I like so, that. I love when you save that cow, those cows from the slaughterhouse and all that shit.
Once she started showing me videos, I couldn't unsee it.
Mm.
Like of the way food production is and meat production, it was hard for me to unsee.
Are you a vegetarian now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not able to get, like, she's vegan and won't use any products. It's like I'm just doing the best I can with it.
I'm doing a little bit of fish.
Yeah.
Well, but what about leather and you know, clothing,
only
shoes?
Leather only if I
for those hot pants you wear.
Strangle the cow myself. I have to, because it used to be I was big into meat and the animal had to be killed in front of me.
Oh.
Every restaurant I went to, I would say, give me a burger, but I need the cow to
be brought
out. I need to see the cow. I need to look him in the eye.
And ask his permission.
So what's crazy about it is when you're around them, that you realize, like, oh, sheep have different personalities. Like, it freaks you out for a second.
Yeah.
Because you go, oh, you're kind of a being.
Right.
You're not just a...
Right.
Like, a lamb is maybe the cute.
They say a cow is, like, as smart as a three-year-old.
Oh, yeah. And so now I only eat three-year-olds. Three-year-olds and below.
I'm with you on that.
That's where I'm at.
And pigs, too. Like, they're like
amazing.
The nicest people.
We have these two pigs, Anna and Maybelle, right?
Anna and Maybelle are pigs that live on your farm,
pigs.
Yeah.
600 pounds now.
Jesus.
But they're so playful. You walk out and you go like, Anna, Maybelle. Kong, kong, kong. They come running. You pet their belly a little bit. They flop over. Uh-huh. And they just lie there and they're like, this is the best day ever.
Right.
Like
there's a relationship.
There's a relationship. And I think once you see that, you can't unsee it. And it's hard. And now it wraps into the whole other thing. So people are upset about the exploitation of their part of the world. So like now all the barbs are like sexual politics in the offices. No question that's a problem. But many of those people have no problem with iPhones or shit that's made by people, like actual people who are exploited in the process of making the goods and services.
Because there's so many dark and ugly. You go down a path, you can't get out of the path.
And you can't, right. So in New York City, so somebody can be absolutely unbelievably furious at the use of a word that is not the proper word and step over homeless people every single day on their way to work.
Yeah.
Like, we can't, you, no matter how woke you are, everybody sleeps sometime.
Right.
And I think that maybe that's the conclusion of all this, is we're not really going to get anywhere if it's just all claws.
You know what I was thinking? Like, yeah, like when I was watching on the Today Show, I said, okay, this guy comes out of retirement for like 5 minutes. And the next thing I know,
you're getting
hit with Louis C.K. and everything right. else. And I'm like, man, yeah, like, he probably,
I'm part
just,
of the story.
You just want to get out of this shit storm, right?
That's,
I mean, you just
exactly
want to go
right.
back to the farm. How much does it cost to run the farm every year? Like,
it's,
I mean,
a lot.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah,
right?
You don't want to do. And the interesting thing is, so we've had real trouble with the town regulations of the town we're going to, with the farm.
Oh, really?
And the reason is because we don't kill the animals. Right. If we ran a slaughterhouse,
you'd be okay. They'd be fine.
You'd be like,
well, why
oh,
is
okay.
that?
So there are farm protections for production.
Right.
I mean, they exist for a good reason, like
right.
so that you can't just subdivide behind a farm and then be like, now that we live in a beautiful subdivision, we don't want to smell your animals anymore. And you're like, well, we were a farm and you are unfortunately going to have to smell our animals.
Right.
But if you don't kill them, then you have a lot more regulation to jump through because you're not protected. There's no real right to farm protection.
Unless you eat these or
unless
put
you
them to market.
Them. That's correct.
Wow. That's
so
crazy.
It's kind of crazy. But
yeah.
what's really interesting about having these animals then is veterinarians want to come to your farm because they never get to see these animals geriatrically.
Right.
Oh.
Like, here's one that'll blow your mind. Have you ever seen a male Holstein cow?
No.
Exactly. The black and whites.
Right.
You've never seen a male. The male, so up at Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen, are male Holsteins. They are like elephants.
Right.
They're gigantic.
Oh.
Gigantic. They're maybe almost twice the size of a female Holstein, which are, you know, pretty
wow.
big. And they are gentle giants.
Are they like elephants in the sense that they have like family and they
oh my God,
they
yeah.
grieve over death and all
yep.
that kind of, yeah, right?
There's, no
it's
question.
An emotional thing.
It's an absolutely emotional thing. And when you see them, you really feel, you know that scene in Jurassic Park where like they first get there and the brontosaurus comes by and they're all like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
When we went up to Watkins Glen to the farm sanctuary and we were standing, you know, atop this beautiful hill and you see it, and Susie Cosen, who is the, she's like this incredible caregiver for the animals, and she really is the one who kind of, she knows, it's like having patients, and she knows all their names and she's able to go in. She calls them and they all come running. She goes, oh, here comes Frank. Oh my
Aww.
God, there's, you know, and she knows all their names and she knows their personalities and she, and they all come moving through, and it really is, it's like beautiful.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing that with my wife and the cat thing that
yeah.
she's doing, and like, wow, I mean, it's just overwhelmingly emotional.
Yes.
And, geez, I really dig it. I like being involved in it.
Well, there is something yeah. about yeah. having us all live in cities where we never even see where things come from.
Not knowing
and
where your food comes from is a yeah. big,
but what were you
a
about
big
to,
deal.
What were
yeah.
you about to say? You were just about, you pointed to me and I said, I'm really digging being a part of it.
Oh,
and
I was probably just,
you
I
forgot.
Pointed at you. And
yeah.
said, it was probably, I didn't wish you Le Chateau Nova.
Oh, I see.
okay.
So, yeah. so you know, the other thing, the impression I get with you is too, that like, even though you spent years doing stand-up comedy and you know all these guys, you're not that emotionally attached to stand-up comedy. Like when I talk to Seinfeld, this guy,
right.
he loves it. He lives it. He loves
That's
to break down a joke and analyze it, and it's really fascinating. I enjoy being around him. I've gotten to know him somewhat, and
right.
he really.
But he's also the best. Like now, you're talking about the kind of craftsman. Like he's the guy that you would go to, like in an old Italian village, where like there's this one guy,
right?
And he does these, like
brick. Who else is like that? Leno? Is he? Because he was,
you know,
a great
I don't
stand-up.
Know Jay at all because it's. You know, he was always in Los Angeles and he was up before. And I've gotten to know Jerry just a little bit more from being here. But your comedy friends, it's interesting. You know, you go out after shows and stuff, but I was never a hangout guy.
Right.
Like I didn't. So there wasn't a lot of, he was much more of a hangout guy. Like they yeah. all used to get together for brunch and
right.
then they'd go to a game. And
you
all
don't
that.
Do that.
No, I'm kind of a hermit. Like it's.
But isn't there a certain necessity to hanging out because then you kind of learn from
when
other
you're in
guys?
The, when you're in the clubs.
I
so
see.
That was during my club years. Yeah, I was always at the club.
Hanging out. Right.
And you would hang out afterwards and you go to diners and shit like that. But I wasn't, you know, everybody come over to my house. We're going to go away for the weekend or screw around. Like it was work related.
So you're not
super fun.
So now in your semi-retirement or whatever this phase is, you're not hanging out with a lot of comics.
No.
Have you talked to Letterman about retirement? Because it seems to me like I told you I admire this. You were able to walk away from a big show and highly rated and highly respected and funny, and you had the whole machine working for you.
Right.
I admire that walking away. I don't know, you know, one day I guess I have to walk away from this, but I would
but
have.
But you found a balance. You were able to find a balance. First of all, you're in a different place in your life.
Right.
So once your children are grown, it's a whole thing. So I have kids that are 13 and 11.
Right.
And I was missing that.
Yeah.
I would see them in, you know, I saw them at crying times.
Right.
You know, put them to bed and like just before school.
Oh, right. Dear.
And what did you do? Did you say you looked at your bank account and said, I got enough money that I can walk away.
That's right.
And I can spend some time with my kids, which few people get that luxury.
And, you know, thank God. So last year, my son had a health crisis and like, thank God I was home. Thank God that I was there for that process.
What was the crisis?
Well, he has something called celiac disease, which is not that uncommon. And a lot of people know about now. It's a gluten immune disorder.
Right.
Where you can't, something about your body attacks it and it ruins your lower intestine, the villi. And he used to have these episodes where they would last about 4 to 6 hours. He'd be in tremendous pain and then he would vomit and then he would be okay. And we finally got him diagnosed with celiac when he was like 8 years old.
Yeah.
So we took all the gluten away. But he kept having these attacks every now and again. And we were kind of like, oh, I guess he got like a little bit of gluten. And that triggered that and he had an episode. And as he got older, it started to happen more frequently and more painfully.
Mm.
And so then we started thinking, well, shit, maybe it's food dye. Because like he drank a Gatorade and he had an episode. And I was like, I bet it's yellow dye or red dye.
Yes, he's trying to figure it out.
So now we're trying elimination.
Yeah.
And the poor kid. So now he's, you know, 11 years old, 12 years old. He's losing weight. He's anemic. And he's down to like vanilla pudding and bananas.
Jesus.
And he's still having these episodes and they're still really painful. And so finally he's got a celiac doctor up at Columbia Presbyterian. They say, you know what? This is, you know, weird. And this lasted now for 5 years. Bring him in here. We're going to do an MRI on his belly. And we're going to see. They think it's something called intussusception or something. It's your tube, your intestines swell and telescope.
Jeez.
And then it's like a muscle contortion. So he goes in. We're there. I'll never forget. It was the Sunday after Thanksgiving last year. Goes into the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. It's a Sunday. It's after the holiday. It's like pretty empty. He drinks. You have to drink that fluid, the contrast fluid.
Yes.
He gets through one bottle and I just see it. He immediately goes into an episode and he is in like literally to the point where, I mean, sometimes we would have to bring him to the hospital and they have to give him morphine.
Wow.
So they rush him to the emergency room and they give him morphine and some other shit and we're there the whole time like, let's just hope he throws up because when he throws up, usually he feels better. They do an ultrasound. His left kidney is 3 times the size of his right kidney.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
He has a blockage in his kidney. Hmm. And that's what's been the problem. It was not. So he has celiac.
Right.
But his reaction to it is not nearly that severe. What was happening was he had a congenital blockage on his left kidney. When he would drink, that fluid is a diuretic.
Right.
So Gatorade, the contrast fluid, salts, other things
rushes
like that.
Rushes the fluid into the kidney.
Correct.
Right.
So if he's got a blockage, your kidney swells.
Oh, now, my God. Kidney, and this is going on for years.
Years.
Wow.
It can't burst. Hmm. So what happens is you have something called, I guess it's called a fornix. It's like a pressure valve on a radiator. It releases, his urine releases into his body inside and creates like a weird scaly thing on your kidney. And then as the kidney deflates, it's they called it a vasovagal reaction. And that's what made him throw up.
So when they do the operation, do they take his kidney out or do they?
No. So what they did, and thank God, and this dude, I mean, his name is Dr. Casal, and they used to do it where they open up your whole side and they go in and they like take the kidney out and do it. He goes in with like arthroscopic tools.
Yeah.
And it was so wild to watch because it really looks like a crazy Edward Scissorhands contraption that he's in. And you take the tube that connects the kidney to your bladder and you take it, you remove it, clear the blockage, reattach it, and then let it flow again. The problem is he's left with like lasting damage. You know, he has what's called hydronephrosis. It's an enlarged kidney with like pooling. So he's on, you know, he has to take medication.
But he's not experiencing these episodes anymore.
It's like being reborn.
Wow.
It's like he's given a new lease on life because he was having like a dark night of the soul. I mean, he really was like, what is life? Like, why am I here?
I'm in constant problem.
If I'm in constant pain and I don't know what to do about it. And it was terrible to watch.
Kills you as a father, right? I mean, because you feel helpless. How do I help this kid? And it's he's my son.
Unbelievable. And the worst part about it is you think back to those nights when it'd be Sunday night before school and he's like, oh, my belly. And you'd go, you're just nervous.
Right.
Come on, man.
Yeah. That's when you feel guilty.
You're going to school tomorrow.
Right.
You know, you've missed too much already.
Yeah, these shenanigans are not going to go on.
Now you're sitting in a hospital room and like, they're like, we're going to have to cut him open and remove a thing. He's been living with having kidney stones like every 3 days.
Oh my God.
And you're like,
that's real pain.
That's real pain.
Yeah.
And I still it's hard not to get choked up thinking about it because it was horrible. And the whole experience, you know, it really, I remember saying to him, like there was one night we were in the hospital, in a children's hospital, he's having a really rough time. There's a lot of pain. I said, I know, honey, but you know, everybody here is just looking for an answer.
Right.
And we're the lucky ones who got one.
Yeah.
Like, because there's a lot of kids there. Like, they don't get an answer.
No.
And they're not coming out.
They can't figure it out. Right.
And you can't, and like, and they're not going to make it. And it's crazy.
It hits you like a ton of bricks. And as a father, you feel the worst guilt is when you can't save your kid.
Oh.
The worst. Like, you're like, I know I'm supposed to come up with an answer, but I don't know what the answer is.
And we're used to, and it kind of gets back to too, like, not too many stories, not to tighten it up, but, you know, we are people of like connections and money.
Right.
And you always figure like connections and money, what else do you need?
You got it licked, right?
That's right. Yeah. But it doesn't save you heartache. And that's what's so interesting about like Robert and Michelle Smigel, who started this foundation. So their kid, Daniel, I guess he's 19, he's going to be 20 soon. You know, he had autism at like one. He was one of those kids that was like, it regressed, like was out and then regressed into it. And they couldn't find a school. Now this is, man.
Yeah, and by the way, Bob Smigel is a guy, you know him from Triumph the Insult Dog.
Right.
He's been on our
right.
show and all that. He's a very funny guy.
Unbelievably funny, unbelievably successful writer. So now they have a kid who they can't
communicate with.
They can't communicate with, and they have nowhere to take him to a school. So they start this foundation to start a school in New York. I think it was called the McCartan School. That was
for kids with autism.
Yes.
Yeah.
On the spectrum. But it's such a wide variety on the spectrum. It turns out his son, Daniel, it's not an appropriate school for him. So they start this school that they can't use. Now they got to move out to New Jersey to find
services.
I mean,
the school they started was not appropriate for their kid.
That's right.
Wow.
Because Daniel, you know, he had a lot of self-injurious behaviors, still does not communicate verbally, you know, is a more difficult case to get him to be able to live his best.
Have they ever gotten any closer to figuring out what the hell causes this autism? Because it seems like it's rampant. And I know some people were thinking it was like, you know, inoculations for a while and all that, but no one really knows.
No. And this is this charity is not about the science. There's a lot that do that. This really is about services. They fund services because families, man, it's hard.
It's hell and it's expensive.
It's expensive as hell.
So does this, the thing you're doing on HBO, which is, that's going to be Night of Too Many Stars this Saturday, November 18th. It's going to be a live show on 8 p.m. on HBO. A lot of great comics are going to be there and all this. It's to bring awareness and money donations to this cause. But to do this, does this fall under the umbrella of your deal with HBO? It has nothing to do with it.
No, I've been doing this.
You're not the producer of this?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you
so
are.
We used to do it. The first one we did, you know, that I hosted, I think we did it on NBC. And then we did it a couple of times just at the Beacon Theater. And then when I went to Comedy Central, we got to do it on there for a few years. So as part of that other thing on HBO, I asked them, you know, would you be interested in this? Because you know, I'm not on Comedy Central anymore, and we'd love for you to do it. It's a great cause.
And they and took it up.
They took it up.
Is doing it live dangerous? Like when, I mean, well, I mean, in the sense that you got a bunch of comedians coming out there. And again, with all this constant criticism and all this, somebody comes up and do you have to sit there and vet their routines and all that?
No.
You're not going to do that.
No, I mean, you get, like you say, you got to, it's more like, it's easier to say you're sorry than ask for permission. Like you're going to live with the consequences anyway. There's no way to outsmart the internet. You just can't do it. There's nothing. There's nothing you could say that if someone's not going to come up and be like, you know,
you're going to get a poison dart in your neck.
That's
one
right.
Way or another.
It doesn't matter. But
so get back to your deal with HBO. So when you leave Comedy Central and you're on fire with The Daily Show and all that, and your reputation is so great and you're successful, and you decide to leave, does every broadcast company in America contact you, or was it just HBO? I would imagine a lot of people contacted you to do some stuff.
There was people contacting, but I kind of didn't want to do anything. The only thing was I was neurotic about not having work. Because I know that, and I don't know if this is what has driven you to stay, because I know there's been moments where you've thought, you've gotten to that point.
I want to leave.
And you've said, I got enough money, I'm done, I want to leave. Yeah. But maybe there's something inside you that's like, but you know what? I know if I leave, when I'm idle, my mind just takes over and knocks me out.
Yeah, because like, what do you do all day? Like, are you writing comedy all day? Or are you reading the newspapers? Or if you read the newspapers, it takes you back into that world of the Daily Show, right?
I've gotten into a good rhythm.
What's the rhythm?
So the rhythm is we get up, kids get ready, do school, and then I'll like spend about 3 hours on ideas I'm writing, like film stuff or things like that.
Right.
Maybe a little bit on some stand-up stuff because I still like to come into the city like once a month and do stand-up over at the Cellar.
You
do? Something like that. Yeah, I'll try and do that.
And that's fun for you?
Fun. That's really fun.
Going up and just like not a big gig, like just go to the Comedy Cellar.
Right. Because here's what I don't get in my day. I don't get to talk to people.
Right.
The one thing I miss about the show is...
That camaraderie.
And also, it was a way to process shit. Like when terrible things would happen, we would sit in that room and we would talk.
Yeah.
And just, you know, as we were trying to filter to get through the day, like I kind of don't have anyone to talk to.
Right.
So that's the weird part. But so I'll do that. Then we kind of do, the kids are schooled because of the health thing, like mostly at home.
Right. Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah.
Is that weird for them? I mean, do they ever say to you they want to go to school and hang out with other kids?
Well, so we'll still bring them over to their old school like once a week, twice, you know, whatever, to like go lunch, recess, some other shit.
But this was as a result of the health scare.
That's where it started, yeah.
Yeah, because you said, hey, we can't put you in school. We got to watch you.
And it was the stress of him feeling like he was falling behind and all that.
What's homeschool like?
Uploaded by the World of Howard Stern channel.
Hire a teacher?
It's good. It's hard. Homeschool can be hard because, like, you know, we're putting on a play and they tried out and they're just not that good.
You have to reject your own kid?
No, seriously,
what is it? Like you hire tutors and stuff?
That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
So that part of it. So then I'll get to like, I'll bring them like lunch over there, whatever. We'll do that.
You know why I think that's good? I think the level of teacher you get is unbelievable if you can afford to do a homeschooling situation. Like you're going to get the creme de la creme.
It's not even so much that you afford it. It's more like school is designed for more of like a factory system. So basically school is designed, you're there from 9 to 3 because they figure your parents are 8:30 or whatever it is. Your parents work, they're going to drop you off. You can't just go to work and leave them.
Right.
And generally households are now 2-income. So it exists to serve a certain purpose, but a lot of it's wasted time. And what you're basically doing is just foisting all your problems onto teachers.
Right.
And saying like, could you deal with this for like 8 hours? And by necessity, you're in a class with 20 other people. And I do think to some level, school is not connected to what the world actually is.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how you felt about it, but like,
I hated it. It was horrible. It was just the worst experience. I bet your kids are getting turned on to a whole bunch of stuff that is good.
Well, also, like, why would you, schools pretend that Google doesn't exist?
Right.
Like, in the same way when we were kids, remember when calculators came out?
Yeah, and they said you can't use them.
And you're like, but why not? I'm pretty sure in the world, like, when you're at work, your boss is never going to go, and remember, do your work in your head.
Yeah.
Don't ever use
When you talk about your day, okay, so the kids are doing the homeschool thing and all this. You're also the executive producer of Stephen Colbert's show, right?
Yes.
Which is amazing when you think about all the guys who came out of Daily Show and your whole thing. I mean, everyone right. is, I still think Comedy Central blew it because they didn't hold on to these guys.
Yeah.
I mean, that's weird to me. HBO got John Oliver, Colbert right. went to CBS, Samantha Bee was out of your, yeah. right? She's doing real well. Yep. There's a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
So when you're named the executive producer of Colbert, are you actively involved in that, or is that just something where you kind of check in once in a blue moon?
More check in.
I know.
More, you know, it's really to be there to kind of when they need me.
Yeah.
Like if they want to talk, but I also don't want to get so involved into their daily production because they really know what they're doing. And the show flows through Stephen.
Right.
And so it was really more a question of support when you need it. You
and know, Stephen,
you want to talk, you want to bullshit about it, that's great, and we do that.
In a weird way, if Stephen loses Trump, he loses everything. Like he's,
is that the end?
No, I disagree.
You know what? But you, come on. When he sits and does that monologue, it's a real turn on. He's good at it.
He's very good at it.
But he needs a political foe,
I think he would have figured it out without Trump because what he did, when he shed the Colbert Report, right?
Right.
He shed the character. And I think to some extent, he thought to himself, well, that character had a lot of opinions about politics, so let me shed those too.
Right.
And so he forgot that he was kind of the fuel driving that character. And so the show became more anodyne. It became sort of vanilla because I think he wasn't sure.
He was lost.
Am I still allowed to have right. opinions as myself?
And when he took his opinion, everyone kind of dug right. it. That was it because that's what he right. does best.
Right. And he's such a, like, philosopher king. Like, I've never seen a guy. He can quote the Bible, chapter and verse, by heart, and Lord of the Rings.
I know.
Like, I don't know
he's
anybody.
A brilliant guy. Very funny guy.
A brilliant guy. And a very nice guy.
See, I thought you would have turned to a guy like Letterman about retirement. Although right. Letterman now is coming back to Netflix because I think he got a little bit bored. I don't know that Dave really wanted to leave showbiz. I think he just saw the environment.
Oh, really?
My theory was...
Do you talk to him now? Is he a guy, like, I would not feel comfortable calling him or something. Not that I have his number, but
right.
I don't know that I would feel comfortable.
No, I don't. We don't speak real. He's called me once or twice about something, mm-hmm. but it's a very quick conversation.
Have you seen him since he
yes.
left?
Well, yeah. He's been on our show. He came up here to say hello, actually, which was really nice. He came to see what I was up to and visited. And now I'm going to do his Netflix show. He asked me to do
nice.
That, which I didn't even know what it was, but it's evidently like a 90-minute thing in front of a live audience. And
then, oh, really?
And then you do a field piece and all that. But he's only doing six of them.
Oh, that's the gig.
Yeah.
That's the gig, baby.
See, that's why I was thinking about you. Like, maybe you do something like that.
Yeah, that might not be. I'd
Are you trying
like
to figure out something
stand-up.
To do on HBO? Is that it?
I'd like to do maybe some stand-up, do a stand-up show maybe, or, you know, do a special maybe at some point down the road. And I'd like to, I have a couple ideas for films.
How much material do you have? If I say to you, let's shoot an HBO special tomorrow, how much material would you have?
I got some old Saddam Hussein jokes that I think.
Oh, really? So, it's that old, huh?
That'll crush.
Still doing that Saddam Hussein stuff?
Oh, you love it. All you have to do is change the names and it all works out fine.
Netflix never approached you? I would imagine there was some sort of bidding war there.
There wasn't a bidding war. And again, to go back to our relationship with the internet, just like a week ago, an item on the internet comes out. Jon Stewart turns down $50 million a year from Netflix because otherwise his wife will leave him.
Oh.
And that is true. I know that.
That's terrible.
Why? I said to my wife, I said, why would
yeah,
you
why
leave
are you
me?
Leave? Yeah. Well, what I did thought, she say? Did she said, come well, clean just, about this?
She doesn't
this?
Like Netflix? What yeah. are you talking about?
She said, sometimes a woman has to take a stand.
Right.
And that's why.
Yeah. Sounds like crazy. A good life. I mean.
I'm really so proud of what we did over at The Daily Show and all those things.
Are you proud of all these guys who now yeah. come out of there?
Yeah, they're so. I mean, in some ways, you're super proud. And in other ways, you think, my God, did I have that guy in a bottle? Like,
yeah.
You know, Samantha is just like this incredible force. And you're like,
do you watch her show?
I don't watch a ton of the stuff. Like, I'll check clips.
Right.
Like, you'll see a clip.
Will you check Colbert because you're the executive producer?
Oh,
or you...
yeah, but again.
But not every night.
You don't watch every night.
No, I don't watch. You know what I watch is the superhero shows with the kids.
Yeah, which ones are you watching? That. I watch every one of them.
The Gifted, Flash was our favorite. And that's still good.
It's okay now.
Yeah.
Gotham is very good.
No, I haven't seen Gotham.
Oh, that's
We Are Flash.
I watched that.
Gotham might be a little Gifted too dark.
Gifted
is a good
one. Gifted, I just started. Supergirl, you watching?
I watched it for a while.
You lost
And now
it.
I feel like, oh, we're going to really talk a lot about relationships, aren't we?
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of relationship stuff.
You want to see her be Supergirl.
You know what I had real high hopes for?
What?
This Marvel Inhumans.
I watched the whole season. I didn't think it was great, but I stuck with it.
Was not good.
It was terrible.
Terrible.
Because who wants to watch superheroes who don't use their powers?
They don't use their powers.
And they talk too fucking much.
Here's what I also think they should have gotten. Superheroes with the power of acting.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's just frustrating.
Your league, you know, they got Black Bolt, who is this incredible character, but he can't talk. So everything is...
Sign language.
You know, and then everybody has to turn around and go, well, he thinks that we should...
See, I didn't think you were watching superhero shows.
Oh, that's all we do now.
No kidding.
Because they're 13 and 11. It's... I'm so happy they're out of the Nickelodeon Disney world.
Yeah. Iron Man, you must like when you see the movies too,
yes,
right?
We go see the movies.
You go see the movies, the whole thing.
Like that. Because that is honestly, like, what a great, I knew I wanted to hang.
Yes.
I was so preoccupied when I was doing the show, and it was all the time and all day. I would go in, we'd sit, we had this very insular world where we would knock around these ideas, we would do that, it would go, and I'd get home at 9 o'clock at night. And that was my whole life.
Right. You know what? I tell you, I mean, when I think back on my life, because my kids always say to me, Dad, you were always working. You were always working. And I was like, yeah, I was. I didn't know how to function any other way. I had to make a living. I wanted to support the family.
What is your relationship like now with the kids? Because you have the dual thing. So you were working real hard, and also there's a divorce.
A divorce.
Involved.
Well, I've worked really hard on myself.
Right.
To be the best dad I could be, which is not to say I'm the best dad, but I've really tried my best to be connected and really communicate with them. And I got to say, I feel like I'm in a really good place. I had to sit and figure out how can I make a relationship with my kids without my wife. Mm-hmm. In other words, so many guys depend on their wives to sort of like, oh, you know, Dad's busy working. Don't worry about it. They make all the excuses and they say, oh, you know, Dad loves you, this and that. When you're divorced, you either can check out, which is what your dad did, or you can say, how do I make a relationship with the kids that's authentic and real, even while continuing working and stuff? And it's, you know, it's been really great. I feel closer to my kids than ever.
Will they ever raise with you frustrations, complaints, you know, that go down deep about that it broke up or that you weren't there? How old were they when that happened?
Well, it started when they were young, but, you know, they really kind of sat me down and, you know, gave it to me. They didn't like the idea of divorce and they were miserable about it. But we, even now, we've done work in our relationships pertaining to that divorce. And why it happened or, you know, or how it affected our relationship. And we talk about it all the time. And I think it's the healthiest thing in the world. And I've learned not to be threatened by it. Like, I used to get very, like what you said in the beginning.
Like the defensiveness.
The defensiveness. Yeah. I first would be like, well, what, you don't understand the reason. Blah, blah, blah. And then I finally went to shut the fuck up. And like, and listen, because this is how they feel. And why can't they express it? And why do I have to be threatened by it?
My relationship with my father ended. Not because of the divorce, but because of his behavior. I wouldn't even say in the immediate aftermath of the divorce, but down the road.
Mm.
And the problem happened because as your relationship atrophies, as it can do in a divorce, especially with someone who is not available, you no longer have a strong enough foundation to weather bad behavior.
Right.
And so that's his inability. Because I did get to a point where I understood marriages don't work sometimes.
Right.
People fall out of love. But what I don't understand is what you just said, which is, but why wouldn't you at least put in some work to yourself to help get in touch with what some of the feelings that I might be having.
Yeah, if your father had been a strong enough man, he would have been able to go somewhere, get some help and say, listen, I got to figure out how to communicate with my son. and how to make a relationship with them. And it is the most difficult thing in the world to do that work. And I'm actually moved when I talk about it because I know how hard it is. Mm. And so I always say to guys who get divorced, I say, get yourself into therapy, like with a really good therapist, because you got to learn how to connect. You know,
well, he had a good therapist. It's a Slivovitz. It's a brandy.
Yeah.
And
well, your dad died in what, 2013? So
yeah,
right. And did you guys have a reconciliation of any kind? Or
no, it was very interesting. So, you know, my father's never met my children when they were alive, and now my kids are the age that they are. My kids are around the age that I was when my parents split up. So what happened there was such an
Did you go to his funeral?
So I did go to his funeral.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, this is hard to talk about. So he was a depressed guy. And I know that now there's, and his family is some mental illness and things like that. And he would drink. But when they got divorced, I was glad that he didn't live there anymore because it was violent and it was terrible. Huh. And he went through a period where he lost his mind. He'd been working as a scientist at RCA and he hated it. And he was a guy, Kim, you know, always did the right thing. You know, he was in the army, in Korea thing.
An accomplished guy.
An accomplished guy, but not as accomplished as he wanted to be or that as he thought he was. So there was a strange combination of arrogance and insecurity. And he, you know, was so fascinating. So they split up. And I was very young. And he and I just never really connected. He connected a little better with my brother because my brother is a smarter guy. You know, they're both sort of brilliant in an analytical way.
Were you left with
the
feeling, why did he even have kids? Like, what was his thought process there?
It's not that I was left with the feeling of, why did he have kids? Is that, why doesn't he like us more? Why doesn't he see? And now that I have children, it actually made me angrier. But, so what happened was, we don't have much of a relationship. Now I'm 17 years old. So it's been 7 years. And I'm going down at a grandmother who used to live in Brooklyn, but now she's out. She's older. She's in a retirement community in Lakewood, New Jersey. He calls me up. It's about 2 weeks before I'm about to leave the college. And he goes, come with me. I need some help moving some of grandma's stuff out of there. Now we have a relationship at this point. Like basically I see him, I don't know, once a month and maybe a little bit less. He's closer to my brother. We don't really talk. We're in the car. And he says to me, you know, I haven't been, you know, with your mother in a long time. What do you think about if I got remarried? And I'm like, I don't care. Do what you want. Mm-hmm. What do you think? You know, if I may end up starting another family. Okay. I am married and I have a 2-year-old.
Oh, boy.
I go, are you fucking kidding me?
Oh, my God. Good thing I agreed.
Good thing I agreed. So then, and then like a week later, I'm off to college. My next interaction with them is I worked for a landscaper. I was cutting the lawn at the little apartment complex that they lived in. Like it was bananas. The whole thing.
Did you
was,
know he lived there?
Well, I did then.
Yeah.
But I didn't before. Right. He had this sort of fake little apartment that he had in Princeton that was, you know, like a hovel. Hmm. And
that's where he'd see you.
And the woman that he did it to was the woman that he had an affair with. So it was all very complicated. And he never could cop to that. And so when I got into this business, he was never support. He was never the type of guy to be supportive or anything like that. And he would just feed me a ton of shit.
Saying like...
Always passive aggressive.
Like a bad, this is a bad, when are you going to get a real job kind of stuff?
When are you going to get a real job? Until like... I remember when I got Letterman and he was like, I thought they used experienced people. And you're all right.
Geez.
So it was a lot of that shit.
Nice guy. Jealous.
But so that was fine. And it just sort of atrophied. And then one night I can remember it was after my grandfather died. I was very close to my grandfather. And he calls me up.
Your mother's father or your father?
My mother's father.
Your mother's father, yeah.
My father's father had died early. He was a cab driver
right. From
Brooklyn and like not in the best health. Like one of those guys that like, you know, got syphilis and Guadalcanal. And like at a certain point, you know, you'd be like, just would sit in a corner and rock.
So your grandfather dies.
So my grandfather dies. And a couple of days after that, he calls me and I'm thinking it's about that. And he's in a nostalgic mood, but I can tell he's drunk. And he goes, I've been thinking about when you were born. And so for me,
it's big.
It's big.
Yeah. But he's never acknowledged.
He doesn't acknowledge any that like, the joy we may have had as a family, those kinds of things. And I'm like, you know,
so, here it comes.
So
right?
Tell me about that. Yeah. You know, what are you? He goes, your mother was so bourgeois. And I go, what? She had to go to Doctor's Hospital. Doctor's Hospital was a hospital. It no longer exists, but it was on the, I guess in the 70s on the east side of Manhattan. And they lived in Washington Heights, I think, at that point. It might have been the Bronx. She had to go to Doctor's Hospital. She had to have that status.
And so his memory was your mother was such a pain in the ass.
Such a pain in the ass that we had to go to Doctor's Hospital. And I remember on the day you were born, coming to the hospital, and you know who came out of the elevators? And I go, what? And he goes, gypsies.
A gypsy family.
And I'm like, what? And he's like, ha ha, how about that? You and your bourgeois, but guess who's in your hospital? And
oh,
I was just like,
boy.
Oh my God.
And so,
oh, I thought he was going like you were cursed or something.
So that was the day that I decided.
Those were the great memories. Yeah.
That was the day you decided.
This is over.
We're done.
We're done.
And so did he ever reach out to see your kids or meet your kids? Or did you just say, fuck you, no, or he never even approached?
We didn't really have that. Wow. So then he got dementia.
Right. But what happened when you got like really big with like, you know, even when you had the MTV show and then all of a sudden the Daily Show, you know what I mean? Like you were becoming a presence. I mean, you think he would have like tried to like kind of weasel his way into his successful son's life?
Nah.
He didn't even bother.
Nah, not really.
Yeah. And that couldn't even win him over.
There were moments. And by the way, like if you talk to him, he'd be like, I'm so proud. You know, I was the proudest, you know, and all that.
It's all bullshit.
He couldn't say it to me.
Right. Do you think your whole drive to get famous or to be successful was to say, fuck you?
No.
No.
I think I wanted to do something I was passionate about. But when I went to visit him when he had dementia, because I wanted some, you know,
closure
to be able to say to him, like, at least before he died, I don't know if you could hear anything, like, I'm okay. And I don't blame you. And I'm okay. And like, I found joy and I found love and I found a family and I'm okay. And I still have that with my mother, obviously, and my brother. But I remember going and he had dementia and my brother and I went. And we're sitting with his, you know, wife who he's still married to, and he had two kids. And they're, you know, lovely enough people, but I don't have a relationship with them. And I was watching him, and, you know, and they were feeding him, and he's out of it. And I remember thinking, this poor man, but I didn't feel like my poor father.
Right.
I felt like this poor man, like, I'm sad for this man that this is how it ends. And,
you know, it's sad. Look what he missed out on. Having a son like you and having your brother and like having...
Having a son like that, not like... Because I was a pain in the... You know, I had my problems drinking and drug, whatever that is. But what he missed out on was the unconditional love that you have for your family.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the part that...
So let me ask you, when you decide to have kids... Did you do some work on yourself in order to become a good father? Because when you have a father like that, even though you say, hey, I'm not going to be like him, that ain't enough. I mean, in order to really get, because whatever it was, his coldness, aloofness, or inability to attach to people, there's somewhere that you've seen that and maybe even thought to yourself, like, that's how a man's supposed to be. How do you undo all that?
See, I almost go the opposite, which is,
The kids you love them all the time.
All the time.
But
all the time. But in terms of my drive, it came from my mother.
Right.
Because what happened was, she's a teacher. He's a guy. We don't have much money. And now he's gone. And she doesn't, like, now she's got two kids and no money. And she was just, she taught special ed at, you know, in elementary school. And, I just remember her students, like, they were in the garage. Like, she wasn't in the regular classroom. She was in the garage. And she picked up by the bootstraps. And at the time, it was hard because she was gone a lot. So, like, there were, you know, you were home alone a lot. Like, you sometimes would sleep in the house alone because she was working. But she did it.
Man.
Like, I don't even know how she did it, but she did it. She worked her ass off. And she did what she had to do. And she made sure that my brother and I were always taken care of. And I mean, she was remarkable.
Is she the one who tells you you're funny? Like, she believed in you that you could actually...
She's the one who mostly tells me my sweaters look raggedy.
No.
And who that told the beard you, makes me look old.
Who told you you could be funny and make a living at it?
My friends.
They did?
They didn't tell me I could make a living, but they my friends were the ones that I entertained.
And how old are you when you go to do stand-up the first time?
I was probably 23 or 24.
Oh.
I had lived, when I got out of school, I went to back home to Trenton, lived with a couple of my buddies, and worked in a bar underneath.
Bartending?
I would bartend, yeah. Mm. It was called the bottom half. It was underneath a liquor store.
Wow. On one. Piece that of, is the bottom
half. Just a total shithole. I used to say it was the world's largest blue-collar gay bar.
Dump.
It was a dump.
You're right.
But I also got a job at this club called City Gardens, which was a punk club on Calhoun Street in Trenton. And it was a dangerous, violent place, and I'd never been happier.
Oh, wow.
And it was there that I started to see creative people that weren't, because I
were you good the first time you went up?
No.
Horrible.
Horrible.
So bad.
Bitter end on Bleecker Street.
No one would have bet on you.
Horrible. My first joke, the punchline of my first joke.
I know it.
No, you don't.
If I know it, would that impress you?
That would impress me.
Yidlock.
Oh my God. Oh,
now get out of here.
What do you get for
that? That's nuts. That's Yidlock. Nuts. You know what?
Tell the joke. This is your first joke.
First joke ever. So I go down to the Diamond District in New York. And, you know, I'm just looking to be around my people to absorb some of the atmosphere. Plus, I like seeing men in hats. It's just something I like. All of a sudden, it's lunchtime, 12:30, 1 o'clock, and all the doors, all the diamond stores open at once. And all the Hasidim rush out into the middle of the street to find their way to where they were going to eat lunch. And then suddenly the whole thing comes to a complete screeching halt. Yidlock.
Oh.
And as you can imagine, I would chew on that premise and I would like paint
big
this whole picture
up.
And then I would hit him with Yidlock. And then every now and again, somebody would be like, oh, it's like gridlock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we get it.
Oh.
No laugh, but somebody would say that.
That's interesting.
Look how far you
horrible.
Oh, my God.
Horrible.
Worst feeling in the world.
And I would try different personas, different things.
Oh, yeah? Like, what are some of your personas? What were you?
Seinfeld was such a
influence.
And sort of, you'd kind of grab that rhythm a little bit.
Well,
like, oh, what are you going to... Nothing. just fucking awful. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
How many years does it take before you get good? Like, where you'd say, you know, people said, hey, that guy's pretty funny.
That's hard, because you can get people to say that without being good.
But when did you start feeling good?
I started feeling good. What time is it? Probably around
10 minutes ago.
Yeah, it was probably about 15 minutes ago.
I don't think you're kidding, because isn't it like
you never
like
feel.
When I hear the radio show, I go, oh,
do you
horrible.
Know what I think it is?
Yeah.
Here's what I feel good about. If you ask me, like, what's my best, what made me feel the best about show business? And I, honest to God, it's that I did it. It's that I moved. It's that I mustered up enough energy to pack all my shit into a U-Haul with no job and drove to New York. I had a 6-week sublet and I did it.
You made it work. Somehow it worked.
The climb, the fact that you were successful and you worked at it and you constantly kept going and pushing yourself. It's not a joy necessarily, but it's at least.
No, but I can remember some nights. So what happened was at the Cellar, I was working at this place called Panchito's on McDougal. Doing the day bartending in a Mexican restaurant, which, like, truly the worst job. All you do all day is cut limes and make margarita mix for the night guy who's going to clean the fuck up, and you're going to walk out with a $2 tip out. So, but then at night, I would go to the Comedy Cellar, and back then, it wasn't what it is today.
Yeah.
It was still a basement in the Village, but the show would start at 8, and it would just roll all night. There was no different settings, and it was never packed except on the weekends. And Manny Dorman, who ran the club, and Esty, who books it, put me on as the last guy every night from Sunday through Thursday.
Is that a bad slot?
2 o'clock in the morning.
That's the worst slot, I guess.
It's the slot that they give someone that for some reason they think, let's just see what happens to this guy.
Right.
Let's see what he uses this for.
Right.
And so you develop your act for a jaundiced wait staff and like drunk Dutch people who wandered in and actually thought there was going to be music.
Right.
But
tough crowd.
But you learned how to be yourself.
Hmm.
And once you learn how to be yourself, that's when it opens up.
Right. You're so relaxed.
You learn how to channel what you actually care about.
It's and what you actually
think
about it.
You're right.
And
yeah.
you find your
That's
voice.
That's true in radio.
Yeah. And that's what it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember at what point in radio? Because there was stuff for you, too. You had this outsized personality. See, I feel like now you're doing your best, Howard's. Like, I feel like this was you. You were, the other stuff was performative. I'm going to say this, and people don't know. You're a lovely man.
Really?
I really think. Yeah.
Well, I feel the same way about you.
Thank you, sir.
Maybe we should end it.
Let's end it. Here's the best way we can end it.
But you're right.
The Goo Goo Dolls come out and we all dance.
There is a, but John, you're right. There is a pressure, at least that I felt, that I had to be the most outrageous, that I had to have every single listener listening to me, which is an impossible, unrealistic, magical sort of fucking craziness, mm-hmm. that somehow I could pull that off. So there was no time for anyone else. I had to just be fucking crazy.
But you did it.
Yeah.
You know, but if you had done that in this environment, you would have stepped out over something. You would have burned out faster. It would have been, you were able to keep that going. And I always felt like the turning point for you was the movie and the book. Like, that's when I think you introspected in your career and allowed us to see into it and gave us a little bit of humanity.
Yeah, I think, for me, it was like therapy.
Right. But we didn't get that.
Yeah.
We didn't get to see that as much.
Anyway, so much to talk about. I'm really happy for you.
Thank you.
You're amazing.
And thank you for having me here.
I love when you come in. You should come in more often.
Did you think you couldn't get booked anymore?
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a while.
I don't do anything.
After this HBO special, are you now going to go back to the farm and become reclusive
again?
Because I feel you came out for 5 minutes, you started doing promotion, and the next thing you know, you're getting Louis C.K., getting beaten over the head with a stick. It's like people are chasing you. You're chasing you away with a stick. Everything about everything you hate about fame and success has hit you in like the last 2 days. Meanwhile, we didn't even talk about the fact that I still find it fascinating that somehow, I think in college, you were roommates with Anthony Weiner.
Here's another great example.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
This is the internet. I was never roommates.
We didn't
go to the same college. So people that I went to college with knew him after college when they moved to Washington.
Because
they moved to Washington. So when they would get a beach house, they used to get a beach house in Delaware. I would hitchhike down from Jersey and stay at the beach house. That's it. We were never roommates.
Oh, that's so funny.
And even when I moved to New York, so they say he used to come and hang out in my apartment because his girlfriend lived with me. But that's not true either. I lived with two friends that I'd gone to college with. And then when I moved out finally, when I was like 28 and I finally got my own space, that girl moved in. And then I guess he would go there then, but I was no longer there.
Oh,
but that's
God. Oh my God.
That's my point about rumor becomes truth, becomes orthodox.
That's the lesson for today. John Stewart has left the farm to teach us. And remember, on your way out.
Yes, my friend.
Walk to the west. Avoid that yidlock that occurs.
Is it time for yidlock?
So what are you going to do? You going to go home now or you got more promotion to do?
More promotion. Yeah, because we got to get this. It's on
Saturday. We got to get it. So let me promote here. Watch John Stewart host Night of Too Many Stars.
Yeah.
This is a big deal. There's going to be a lot of big comics there, right?
And it's a great, I'm telling you, these services that Next for Autism provides for families.
Right.
Is invaluable.
So it's for a good cause.
Yes.
And, John has explained it. So what more do you need? I mean, for Christ's sakes, watch the damn thing. It took him a long time to put it together.
Have some fun and donate.
You know who else has a farm? Dave Chappelle. You should exchange farm tips with him.
Another just wonderful guy. He's another guy that I never get to see, but boy, when we see each other, it's just so great.
I know. Dave Chappelle has a farm?
Yeah. Don't you remember in Ohio? He lived anyway.
He's in such a great place, by the way.
I went and did
one of his Radio City shows. I was so happy to see him. We just got to sit and talk, and his kids were there, and they're older now. Like, Suleiman is a man, and it's just lovely.
Those two Netflix specials he did.
Phenomenal.
Excellent.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And he's always, though, I can remember watching him when he was a kid, when he first came up to the Cellar. Just, I think
was he always good?
People. You knew he was going to get better, but he had a way about him that was
funny.
It was just
It's relaxed.
Yeah.
It's so relaxed.
But you knew he had it.
Right. All right, look.
All right.
Watch Jon Stewart host Night of Too Many Stars this Saturday, November 18th at 8 p.m. on HBO. Leave him alone on Twitter. To learn more and donate to Autism Program, go to TooManyStarsHBO.com. That's something else you can do and help
out.
The
Omaze, too. If they go to Omaze.com/Night of Too Many, there's all kinds of things that you can bid on. Like you pay $25 and you get, it's like a raffle for these great experiences. Like you can host Steven's show from under his desk. All of Late Night got together to offer stuff. Yeah, Kimmel did a lunch with he and Matt Damon, an uncomfortable lunch. All the Late Night guys have stepped up and put these incredible things on the table. You can go, you pay like $10 if you want, 10 chances, $25 if you want, 25 chances. If you are selected, because it's random, you get these incredible things.
Wow.
You're a good man. Yeah. This is good stuff.
It's good stuff.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So there is hope.
Why not?
Out there.
Good things are happening in the world. It's not all darkness.
You go, Robin.
Yes.
It's overwhelmingly.
She's so positive. That's why I like working with her.
I do think, though, it's overwhelmingly not darkness. It's just that darkness. Yeah. Darkness pays the rent.
Right.
The thing about darkness is people click on that, not the other stuff.
That's very true.
Yeah.
All right. Listen, we'll be back with brightness. Right after, I might donate to that. I want to donate a lunch with Benji, who works out there.
An uncomfortable lunch with Benji.
All right. We'll be back right after these. We're the great Jon Stewart, everybody. We'll be back right after these.
Blogger Perez Hilton fingers our own Benji Brong.
Perez.
Find his asshole. Ah!
Don't do it hard!
The Howard Stern Show.
Dinner.
Yes.
You remind me of something a caller called into the Tom Hartman Show just today. Paul, that really cool guy that's very bright from California. And, Howard. Howard is on here, Mother. Howard, you're on line one. Come on in.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for your patience.
I suffer from enlarged prostate.
Yes.
I stopped drinking water altogether, and I'm up like 3 times last night peeing.
I was just going to say that has a history to it, how that got to that condition.
I don't get it.
It's absolutely crazy.